right, so tonight I'd like to talk about the two wings of the Dharma, of compassion and wisdom. Compassion and wisdom. And how we often say these two wings need to be developed for the Dharma to really take flight. And in fact, the Dharma can't develop fully without both sides being in balance. So each one of us in this room have a certain tendency. We may tend toward compassion, toward that sense of how it touches our hearts, or toward that sense of wisdom, of what really wanting to understand the deepness of the moment's reality, the deepness of the truth of who we are. So we have often come to practice with one of those biases. Perhaps that's one of the gateways into the practice that resonated with us originally. And yet, if we just stay with our natural gateway, our natural affinity, our practice doesn't deepen. We have to bring both in together for the Dharma to really take flight. Like a bird trying to fly with just one wing doesn't go very far. Now, the classic Taoist symbol of the yin-yang, you know, somewhat cliche in our culture, but it has a very beautiful representation of truth, how these two polar opposites are actually one and the same. How the dark aspect and the white aspect intertwine. The deepest part of the white has the dark in the middle of it. The deepest part of the dark has the white in it, and they blend together. I think this is a beautiful way to hold these two wings of the Dharma, of not two separate things, of compassion and wisdom, but one thing in itself. And so tonight we'll explore how they really inform each other, how they support each other, and what may happen when they're not so developed. Because if we have wisdom without compassion, it's actually very likely knowledge, the intellectual concept, which is masquerading as true knowledge or as wisdom. Compassion shows us the directness, how it actually applies to this body, this heart, this life. So it goes out of the intellect, out of the conceptual realm, into the felt, direct experience. So wisdom in that way becomes really embodied. Now if you have compassion without wisdom, it's actually more likely to be pity or caught in the story, the content. Wisdom starts to show us the emptiness even in the midst of suffering, even in the midst of painful experiences, painful life circumstances. So let's begin by exploring wisdom a little bit. Often when you hear the word wisdom, like that's a wise saying, that's a wise person, that's a wise tradition, to me it brings to mind kind of a fixity, a sense of solidity. Okay, this is wise, something I can engrave in bronze and put it over my door, right? This is the wise saying. That's a wise person. There's a sense of fixing them, making them a noun, something that's unchanging. Yet true wisdom is something that's spontaneously arising to this moment, to what's arising. As soon as a sense of wisdom arises, if we start to solidify around it, we start to say, okay, that is the truth. And we start to develop an ideology, a tradition, a religion around it, then it stops to lose its vitality. It stops losing its trueness, its true relationship to wisdom. We essentially start to build like concrete around it, build an altar around it. It loses its aliveness. So that sense of wisdom, instead of being a noun, a sense of solidity, I prefer the sense of a wise fool. You know, someone who is wise but also has that state of wonder, of curiosity, of not taking things so seriously. Being willing to offer something wise, and the next moment completely let it fall away. So often we confuse knowledge with wisdom. We confuse our intellect, our sense of concept, of our ideas, with what is wise. So we think if you have lots of ideas, lots of thoughts, then you're finally wise. Let's think back to the Wizard of Oz with the scarecrow, when, you know, he finally gets his diploma and he starts reciting all these concepts. But we know that doesn't have a depth of wisdom. This last meditation, how many thoughts did you go through your head that weren't so wise? You know, so how much emphasis do we want to put in the world of thought as being where wisdom lies? So when we do have a deep thought, we have this insight. When it arises, there's a spontaneity, a aliveness in that moment's arising, that if it can transform us. But when we start to take that same wisdom and build this whole concrete altar around it, it loses that power. There's a teacher in our tradition, when he was studying in Asia, he was studying with Ajahn Chah. He was listening to Ajahn Chah, who was one of the Thai forest meditation masters, answer different questions. And he would tell one person one thing, and the next person he might tell a contrary thing, the opposite thing. So this person, when he was still developing, he said, well, where's the wisdom? And like, you're contradicting yourself. And he asked Ajahn Chah about this. And Ajahn Chah said, it's like if we're walking down the road and you're about to fall in the ditch on the left, I say go to the right. If you're about to fall in the ditch on the right, I say go to the left, right? To go to the center. So that sense of wisdom is a spontaneous arising. If you look at the suttas, it's filled with stories, interactions between a living person, the Buddha, and a living audience. And often what he said was directed toward that particular person, what they needed to hear, what they could hear. Right? Same too with questions here. Sometimes a question fits one person and not another person. So wisdom's not about memorization of facts or ideas, be able to list the entire Pali canon by memory. It's really about movement from knowledge into our bones, into our very cells, into the pores of our being. This movement from idea, from concept, into actual known experience. This direct seeing, this direct knowing. It's one of the reasons we emphasize the contemplation, the sense of learning how to attend to your moment's experience with the innocence, with the directness, steadiness, and compassion. Because that allows the best environment to see clearly. And in that clear seeing, then wisdom has a chance to arise. We can move from idea into direct knowledge. It's the difference between thinking about the breath and actually sensing it, actually feeling it. Thinking about the Four Noble Truths and actually feeling them as a lived experience in your lives, how they actually show up moment to moment and in relationship. So this way, knowledge starts to sink into the pores of our being and transforms into wisdom. So what compassion helps with this transition? And I would even say it's what makes it possible. Because if we stay just anchored in the camp of wisdom, we're likely to be caught in knowledge, this kind of addiction to knowledge and facts. I can recite all the different lists, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and, etc. Right? But where's the actual embodiment? This is where compassion starts to come in. Compassion is often defined as the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. The quivering of the heart in response to suffering. And where's thought, where's idea? It's like it's an immediate experience. So in this way, compassion takes wisdom from the impersonal into the personal. It uses the gateway of our own lives to see. It takes the abstract from the abstract to the personal meaning, the direct experience. Now this is interesting because wisdom often points toward the impersonal. But if you go to the impersonal prematurely, avoiding our personal pain, our personal suffering, then it doesn't develop into true wisdom. We have to go through that gateway. As one teacher said, we have to go through samsara to get to nibbana. We have to go through suffering to understand liberation. Otherwise, it risks just being a concept, just being an idea. And a concept blindly followed is very dangerous. An idea, a dogma, an ideology is dangerous, whether it's Buddhist or any other. So let's explore this a little further. So in wisdom, we could say that one of the main bedrocks of wisdom in this tradition are the three characteristics, these three descriptions of reality, of how all conditioned phenomenon are. And insights into these three characteristics is really the development and cultivation of the practice. So the three characteristics, dukkha, the sense of unsatisfactoriness, of unsubstantiality, of a sense that sometimes translated as suffering, sometimes translated as stress, and nicca, impermanence, the state that everything is always in flux, things are arising and passing away. All conditioned states have this as a law. Or to quote the Nobel Prize winner in poetry, Bob Dylan, "He not busy being born is busy dying. Things are always arising and always passing away, including this body, including this me." This leads to the next and the final characteristic of anatta, the sense of self being an illusion, a sense of identity, a sense of who I am is actually a conditioned thing that arises in response to conditions. It arises in response to what's right in front of me, whether it's a sound or a smell or a thought. Right? It seems so solid, this sense of me looking out, but as we look deeper and deeper, we see that's just a thought, it's just an illusion. So these three characteristics, when we see them intellectually, they may have a lot of resonance. They make sense. Even the sense of anatta, it's like that, you know, conceptually that kind of looks, that sounds really interesting, especially to the ego. It's like, I can be a non-self person, you know. That's what I want to become, is non-self, all right? So, and it may stay as a really a cherished concept. But we're not seeing the live truth of this, is that it reveals moment after moment. See, each of these, wisdom is revealed moment after moment. This moment contains the whole range of the Dharma. The whole ray is available right now. In this moment, how you're manifesting right now, listening, sitting. So compassion, this quivering of the heart, takes it from the impersonal knowledge to the personal. From the abstract to the personal meaning, the direct experience. So we start to see this as truths in ourselves, not as an abstract concept. So it becomes wisdom. So life will offer many opportunities to do this. You know, these are what we call some of the, you know, the most difficult experiences. And this is an opportunity to integrate wisdom with compassion. These lessons are constantly presenting ourselves, often in tremendous suffering, kind of on the extremes of our life. You know, when we lose someone we care about, when we have that diagnosis, you know, when our life changes on its head. As many in our room know, that how life presents itself constantly. And we have to have really actively resist learning these lessons, but it's possible. I'd like to share a story from Rodney's time as a hospice social worker. I believe this was in Texas. And how he had two patients that he was working with. One who was very affluent, you know, in our sense of success, had everything, but had a constricted heart. You know, she resisted the fact that she was dying, and her whole environment was filled with tension and fear, and people dreaded going to see her. She had servants, but they all kind of stayed away and only came as little as they could possibly get away with. This other side of town, this woman was in complete opposite circumstances, very destitute, very poor. He tells the story that she had holes in her floor that chickens would pop up, and she would have to use a broom to kind of shoo them down. But going to visit this woman was a delight. I mean, people were just drawn to be with this woman who, even though she was dying, she was near the end of her life. And so Rodney asked her, you know, why are you meeting death with such joy, such peace? And she said, honey, I've held two children in my arms as they died, and I've looked death in the face, and his face is kind. His face is kind. As you hear that story, you see how this sense of your own life passing, that story goes right into the bones, into the heart. It goes beyond the concept, oh yeah, everything's impermanent, to like the sense of I am impermanent. And how do we meet that? So meditation gives us these skills, this toolbox, this capacity is probably a better word, to learn these lessons, to be receptive to these huge lessons which will come to each one of us in this room, who've already come to many of us in this room. So we have this tendency, we have this capacity to be receptive, to actually listen, to hear. And we become receptive to how these lessons manifest in the small ways, in the small griefs, the small disappointments, the small losses, the small joys. This also, the teachings are available moment after moment. It gives us this place of stability, so learning is possible. We're not so swept off our feet. So let's look at these three characteristics again, seeing how they are transformed by compassion. How compassion takes them from an intellectual understanding of dukkha, of anicca, of anatta, into the actual felt sense in our bodies. So dukkha. When I first started to practice in the mid-90s, I was actually going through a very difficult time personally. I was actually going through a divorce with my first wife, and it was one of those things that I wasn't expecting, and the whole... It felt like the whole ground had shifted under my feet. You know, some of you know what I'm talking about. And I heard the Dharma, and the Dharma was conveyed in a very simple way, that resistance times experience equals suffering. So going through this difficult time, I thought, well, that sounds really intriguing, that I'm suffering a lot, and some of that suffering is because of my resistance. So intellectually, it kind of stuck, and I started to really lean into that. I want to understand that. I want to see how that arises. And so, you know, practice went along and I deepened around that. And then I've got a better understanding what that actually meant when I had a kidney stone attack. So I was on a retreat, and being a good yogi, I thought, okay, I'm just going to feel this sensation. I didn't know what it was for a while, so I was just, you know, writhing in the room in pain. Think, okay, that's contraction, pain. You know, for 3 days I did that. I'm a little stoic and stubborn at times. So finally I went to the ER and they said, okay, you have a kidney stone, here's some morphine, and I felt much better. All right? But I thought, you know, I'm being a good yogi, I'm meeting this discomfort, I'm relaxing with it, I'm releasing the resistance, so I minimize the suffering around this experience. But that stone I thought had passed, but it was actually just kind of stuck. And then a few months later, it decided to start to move again. And as soon as it started to move, that pain came back immediately. Intense, you know, very strong. But I also noticed almost at the same time, the fear came back too. The fear of that past experience. The resistance to that past experience. And I could see right there, oh, this is what it means to add resistance to experience. And how that amplified the suffering around that. Oh, what if it's going to be like that last time, and the expense and the suffering? Right? It was added on. Very natural thing to do, but it's added on. So this happens time and time and again in small ways. We anticipate the future being like the past. So So dukkha, the movement from the idea into an actual direct experience. Anicca, impermanence. So I was lucky enough to spend some time with my grandfather, my mother's father, when he was dying. To be, you know, connect with him and be with him. And I was going through some hospice training at the time and had practiced some Dharma, so there's a sense of being very receptive to this experience. And he was talking about, you know, being a Christian man, about how this too shall pass, and how some people held that as one of the most profound statements of the Bible. And he was saying this, and I could tell there's a little bit of solace in it, a little bit of intellectualness of it, that this too shall pass, even though it was very real that he was dying. And then one day he wanted to shave after not having shaved for a few months. So he cleared some space in the hallway, took his wheelchair down to the bathroom, and he saw his reflection after the first time, after 2 months. And his first words were, "Is that me? Is that me? Have I changed that much?" And at that moment, I could see the truth of impermanence was no longer something he could deny. The fact that he was aging and dying was got into his body. The lessons of life are constantly offering this. And finally, anatta, the sense of not self. This one is, it's subtle because we can, the way we look at it is really from the sense of self. So it's kind of like trying to see your own, it's like trying to see from your own perspective. It's like it's a deep perspective that paints the whole shape of how you view life. And until that sense of self falls away, whether for a few moments or for a longer time, and you see the contrast, you see how there's something else that's seeing that's not directed through this mechanism of self. It's just going to stay as a concept. The sense of self loads very quickly in our perception, in our idea of how we see the world. Excuse me. So it's easy to assume it's already there. It's like turning on your computer and the operating system boots on. And then once it's booted, then we can go through navigating the computer. But the operating system is added on to that computer. Excuse me. So too with the sense of self, it gets loaded. Water. It's one of those delights of this time of year with the extra pollen there kicks up the mucus. So excuse me. So it gets loaded on very early on, almost immediately. Not exactly immediately, but it's added on very quickly. We hear something, we see something. The sense of who we are loads up with that. Again, it's conditional to what's there, what's arising. Here's an analogy that might help a little bit with that. So imagine if you're looking through a camera and you're looking at a kind of a narrow focus, you see, okay, I'm looking at Barbara, I'm looking at Peter, I'm looking at so-and-so, all right? That's the sense of self how we usually look from. Thank you, Iris. There's a sense of looking out from a position. Now, if we took that same camera and we panned it out so we see the whole room, or even see further into the landscape, that's a further broadening. But there's still a sense of me looking out. Now, imagine that position of camera suddenly falls away. So you might be looking east, but the simultaneously same time you're also looking west. You're also looking north and south. So you release the position of seeing through the narrowness of eye to just the very spaciousness of seeing. So this sense of movement from self to non-self, to really understanding that, it's much more a process of revealing what's already there. And that's an important clue. If I'm trying to get to non-self, I'm going to be a cat chasing my tail. But if I try to say, okay, let's see what's actually here. What's this assumption of me looking out? I was teaching a retreat this last week with Narayan. I know some of you were there. And this one yogi in an interview was working with the hindrances, these patterns of craving, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt, and seeing how they would just pass through. And as she looked, she could not find in me a sense of her in the middle of that. So that's a movement towards seeing the illusion of self. How normally when we have doubt, we have aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, oh, it's me who's dealing with this, who's struggling with this. But allowing it to pass through, you see the inherent emptiness of that, the lack of self. It's the movement of these three characteristics through compassion, through really seeing it as an experience, not as abstract, intellectual, but directly known, is the transformation from knowledge to wisdom. Since I like to use the analogy of a tree, if you have a tree that's has healthy root system, is really embedded in the ground, in the bedrock, then it can have a beautiful foliage, beautiful tree, you know, branches and flowers. They both have to depend upon each other. You can't just have the roots without the flowers and branches. You can't just have the branches without the roots. So this sense of being balanced. So if you don't have wisdom, compassion then becomes very unstable. It's like that tree doesn't have a strong root system, it's not grounded in the bedrock. So then it gets toppled by a breeze, it gets swayed easily. And this often happens when compassion is our natural tendency, but we're not grounding it in wisdom. So we become overwhelmed, we become washed away by life, by the pain of life. Our hearts are quivering, but our minds are too. We're quivering with the story, the meaning, the pity, the worry, the anxiety. Often when you feel that sense of repetitive thinking, that obsessive thinking around, you're really concerned about something about yourself or someone else. The sense of feeling the emotions, feeling the compassion, but wisdom isn't supporting that. And so the tree is out of balance. The Dharma can't take full flight. We get touched by someone's pain, our own pain, and we get caught in the story. We obsess about the story and the ideas, then we lose this balance. So wisdom takes compassion from the very personal nature of it into the universal and impersonal. So wisdom transforms compassion to show the personalness in context with the impersonal, with the empty. And there's three ways I'd like to just explore that. One is starting to see the commonality of grief, the commonality of loss. Because when we're experiencing a loss, we think it's, oh, this is all mine to carry. Often when I work with people on retreats, it's like they carry the grief so close and so tight, it's this painfulness of this, right? If they can start to say, okay, let me share that grief. Let me open to that, open to the space of the room, open to sharing it with the teacher, sharing with nature, that grief starts to become more and more spread out. This is one of the powers of support groups. When you come with something that the most horrific loss you've ever had, and you sit around a circle of other people who shared the same loss, you realize, oh, this is part of being human. This is part of being a human being. There's a sutta called the mustard seed, or something like that, where this woman was overcome with the grief of her child, so much that she was denying that her child was actually dead. So she's carrying her child around and going to house saying, can you help me? Can you help my child be well? And people would look at her and say, you know, your child is dead. And she said, no, he just needs some help. So she was very, you know, distraught, very lost in her grief, no connection with wisdom. So finally someone said, go talk to the Buddha, I think he can help you. So the Buddha said, yes, of course, I can heal your child. From you, though, I need you to find a mustard seed, a very small seed, very common, from some house that no one has ever experienced loss. No one has ever died, experienced grief. So then she goes house to house saying, do you have any mustard seeds? Yes, of course. But have you had anyone who's died in this house? And they say, oh yeah, my grandfather died, my grandmother, my son, my daughter, my wife, my husband. And as she did that over and over again, suddenly she realized that this was not her own grief. It was her own grief, but it was shared by all beings. And then she had calm. She moved from the compassion that was imbalanced, that was lost in the story, to seeing the commonality of this. That everyone would be feeling this. You know, Rodney had this year-long class on investigating death as a spiritual practice a number of years ago. And one of the exercises we had to do was go to a graveyard and just reflect on all the gravestones, how each of those stones represented grief, represented someone who had grieved that person who had died. And so you look around, you see hundreds and hundreds of stones, and you reflect on all the people who have ever died in the world. And suddenly the grief that I was kind of feeling, that fear of death and fear of grief, it started to open. I realized this is a human shared experience. And then I was walking through a crowd of people and just feeling this deep intimacy, this deep connection with complete strangers. So the sense of commonality, that sense of universality, helps us move from the personal story to the impersonal through the gateway of our suffering, of our pain. Spaciousness is so helpful, that sense of sharing this in a larger space. So often when we are grieving, our eyes, you know, furrow, we get really contracted, as I mentioned. And the Buddha would have these beautiful analogies, these beautiful metaphors of be like the earth. That you can, someone can come by with a shovel and say, I'm going to make the earth not be the earth. I'm going to dig it and throw it away. And, you know, the earth is so vast, it's unaffected by that shoveling. The air, trying to make the air change color with paint, how that would just have no effect on the essence of it. Trying to light the Ganges on fire with a torch, it gets quenched immediately. So all these analogies point toward this vastness of mind and heart, this capacity to hold pain in a quality of emptiness, in a quality of wisdom. One teacher was sharing her experience that after a retreat, she was feeling just the suffering of life. It was overwhelming. It was too much to hold. And her teacher said, well, you're open in the front. You're receiving this pain, but you're not letting it pass through. So open in the front as much as you're open in the back. So you become like a permeable membrane that things are received and pass through. Fully intimate, fully connected to this suffering, but also allowing it to flow through. So these kind of images, these ways of working can be so helpful. And finally, investigation to help move this compassion into wisdom. This is a sense of not going it with the intellect, with a sense of trying to piece out the psychological roots from a kind of abstract way or a clinical way, but much more this quality of really bowing toward the pain, bowing toward it. Because often pain is something we're aware of, we struggle with, but we also keep a little bit at arm's distance. And so be willing to actually bring it closer. What I mean by that is to feel it in the body. Feeling the body as a body experience, as a body sensation. This moves us from the story, the concept, the personal meeting, to the actual felt sense of that. As you do that, as you're still with that quality, sometimes you feel the deeper undercurrent of another emotion, a deeper belief. What am I holding is true? Where is there me in this. And this way, pain itself, the suffering, starts to become a gateway into wisdom. It actually becomes the perfect spiritual practice for us because it shows our own rubs, our own edges. So this movement of commonality of grief, this spaciousness and investigation, can start to move us from an unbalanced wisdom into a true, or an unbalanced compassion into true compassion. This way the tree flourishes because a deep root system and deep foliage. So I'd like to just finish with a poem that it's my favorite Dharma poem, and I would have to resist reading it at every talk I give. So if you've never heard it, that's wonderful. If you have heard it many times, hear from this standpoint of how wisdom and compassion are interwoven, how they can't be one without the other. And it's Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it until your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you've been looking for," then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. All right, can we sit quietly for a few moments? Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. With wisdom and compassion, the Dharma takes flight. Thank you for your kind attention. So we have a chance for any comments or questions or dialogue. And can we turn on the overhead? It's getting a little dark. Thank you. The questions often very help to flesh out the talk, help to move this sense of wisdom being abstract into the personal, into your own experience. Yes, Krista.
From time to time during that lovely talk,
So the
compassion,
yes. So the question was about, was I using wisdom and emptiness synonymously or as interchangeably? I would say there's probably times I was using wisdom as this broader term. And emptiness is kind of the direct experience of that wisdom. Because often we go into wisdom and we can kind of, again, have like, we can write books and we can write, give talks and all those things. But when we go to emptiness, then that conveys the heart of all wisdom. All the sense of stillness that's there, that's transcending words or ideas. It's this direct knowing. No matter, you know, where we find something solid, if we look carefully, we see on its heart that it's empty. And then I was using compassion as a way of moving that from an abstractness to it. Because we can get caught in this sense of abstract, like it's all empty. You know, my mother just died. She's alive, but you know, it's a sense of she's about to have her 80th birthday in a few months here. But that sense of, I can hold a deep grief and kind of hold it at arm's length, using really wisdom as a weapon. And this is a tragic thing to see, that when people kind of paint themselves in these little boxes of how they should be, how they should behave. Oh, I shouldn't be reactive here. I shouldn't be feeling this now, because I'm supposed to be equanimous. I'm supposed to be balanced. So using the Dharma as a weapon, using wisdom as a weapon. Compassion is like a splash of water. It's like, no, you have to see this as a direct experience. So it's a wonderful, if you practice this way, it's like you go into these very deep areas of pain, of suffering, and you see that in the heart there is wisdom. There's emptiness. And in that seeing, then suddenly the compassion is fully available and the wisdom is fully available, and it's perfectly balanced. So the talk was really showing how those need to function together. Yes. You know, I would say the warmth, yeah, I could see it's warmth. It's that sense of to again, repeat for the, what do you call it, internet, the recording, the sense of wisdom being, emptiness being the direct experience of wisdom, and how compassion, you said, warms it. I think compassion makes it a personal experience, a direct experience, not an abstract. So there's no longer a distance between the idea of wisdom and the direct knowing of it. Compassion is what bridges those two. Yeah. Yeah, so we got two. Let's go first with, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so the comment is that compassion allows investigation without a sense of self-judgment. And that's nicely said, because sometimes if we just go with wisdom, then we're kind of like, we have a list of what we should be doing, our good behavior and the bad behavior. And we use, if we get to use Dharma as a weapon to say, okay, we have more refined ways to judge ourselves now. Right? I thought it was just, I wasn't getting my life together, but now it's all this other stuff. Okay. But then compassion says, no, you know, compassion says it doesn't matter what's here. It's the seeing of it. It's the connection with it. It's like doesn't care whether there's pain or not pain. It doesn't care if you're failing or successful. It just meets you. Yeah, that's nicely said. Yeah, so it tempers the harshness of investigation to this sense of kindness, of warmth of heart. Thank you. And you had something? Good.
Yeah, the word emptiness somehow for me feels in my body like the opposite of compassion.
Ah, yeah.
And I think maybe I'm not understanding the context in which you're using, so often we use from the NIV text or translations, but use of the word emptiness, I think it's probably intended to have some warmth in it.
Yes.
But somehow it resonates as an absence.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for that question. So the sense of the word emptiness conjures up this sense of coldness, of loneliness, of absence, of emptiness, absence of everything else, and how it has a certain dissonance with that. Why there, it seems like the it should have a sense of something different. Yeah, and that's a common, not an unusual quality. I think it's both something that gets triggered in us, and our wisdom says, "Okay, that word doesn't quite fit." I don't want to go to this place of desolation where there's nothing here, the vacuum of space. That doesn't bring my heart out. And or if we take the thing, okay, that's going to be something I can just use to create space. Distance is a better word, distance from my experience. So instead of emptiness, it's like it's emptiness. Yeah, it's not a good word really, because it doesn't convey the vibrancy. It doesn't convey the depth of fullness. It's like a roar of silence. It just like, you know, when things are seen as empty, when there's a sense of falling to that sense of stillness, it's not like it's, you know, a flat line. It's like it's so intimate, so alive, so rich. It's like the most deepest, most satisfying experience that you can have, is to have that touching into that sense of that depth of stillness. So when we're talking about empty, I really love it comes from the Zen tradition, it's really teaching around form and formless, that we take something as being solid, that's a solidity to it, an idea, a sense of me. But if you start to see it as inherently empty, empty of substance, doesn't mean it's empty of presence. Or of meaning, yes. Yeah, so it's, you know, those times when you are speechless with joy and with wonder, you know, you see a newborn baby and you just, there's just that, there's no thoughts can arise because it's too big of an experience to hold. Sometimes in grief or in a sense of loss, before grief falls into it, there's just this, you're just so present. Seeing something beautiful in nature, you're just so present. That's living the emptiness.
That's really helpful because I got the feeling that.
Yes.
It almost sounds like it's the emptiness of everythingness.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
The wholeness of richness.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a form at the beginning and middle and
end. Nice.
We don't have a word for
that. Yeah, so I just want to repeat that for the. The sense of this is nicely said. The sense everythingness, emptiness is everythingness. And there's not a beginning, a middle, or an end. It transcends that. And so it probably would be best to pair it with another word, like the empty fullness, empty completeness. Yes, and so that's a good pointer that anytime a dharma, you know, a word. You know, sticks kind of in your throat, like that doesn't quite fit, doesn't feel like my understanding. It's good to ask about it because, you know, language has so many nuances and they're all, you know, often they're translations of a different language, and they're even that in original language is pointing towards something. It's not the actual thing. Yeah, so the heart of it is going to transcend our ideas of it. So it's good to check that out when there's a barrier like that. That's beautiful. Yes.
I'm wondering if the concept of sympathetic joy isn't one aspect of compassion, I think, because it is an expression of opening the heart of the spirit. And I think that our society is more focused, I think, on being aware of and sharing other people's pain is really something harder to share their joy.
Mm. Yeah, nice. Yeah.
When you mentioned newborn babies,
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nicely said. So the comment was about sympathetic joy is that, you know, an aspect of compassion, and how in our society we tend to focus more on feeling someone else's pain and the suffering, and it's actually harder for us to feel someone's the appreciation, the sympathetic joy of someone's well-being and livelihood. And I think that's a nice way of saying it. We could have said this whole talk around sympathetic joy instead of compassion. Because to be sympathetically, have that joy arise without being tainted by envy or by, you know, comparing mind, or I'm being better, I'm worse, or, you know, you can succeed as long as you don't pass me up. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's always easy for the first place person to say congratulations to the second place person. Good job. But, you know, the other way around, it's much harder, right? And because it does point, and I do like how that does, it does push our edge much more, because it asks us to go more into the heart of of emptiness. Yes, I'm more aware of that now, how that I bring up that word a lot. But that sense of in the heart of me being self-centered, self-focused, everything coming back to me, then it is naturally from that logic I'm comparing. You know, am I doing better or worse than you? Are you doing better or worse than my daughter? I mean, it's all this kind of comparing and you know, sense of positionality of that. Okay, but it's all focusing back on this sense of me. If I see that, if I really see this sense of self as just being this illusionary thing, and there's a much deeper thing that is existing before this sense of self, yeah, then sympathetic joy naturally flows. Yeah, so we could easily do the talk, wisdom and sympathetic joy. Yes, Iris. Mm-hmm.
But is that, you know, part of what emptiness is, the sort of imperfection?
Hmm. So the question is around, you know, looking at a piece of paper and seeing how that piece of paper is actually part of, you know, the wind and the clouds, and how these very broad conditions come together. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I haven't heard him say that, so I'm not exactly sure. I'm just going to interpret it through myself, so I apologize if I misrepresent his intention. But we think of a form like a piece of paper. There's a certain way we see it, and there's an idea, okay, I know what this is, right? And we often just stop there. Okay, that projects everywhere. Me seeing you and how I project who you are. I see myself. That's how I am. My daughter, my wife, whoever it is. There's this idea of not seeing through that. But you reflect on how this piece of paper is just a set of conditions. And there was, I like that sense of the clouds coming together, the rain coming together, and how that created the situation for the trees to grow and then to be you know, eventually turned into the pulp. I mean, there's all these processes that come together. That the Buddha would often say when he was trying to teach someone about anatta or emptiness, the conditionality, he would say, you take these different components together, they have a whole, but you take them apart and the whole disappears. And you go through, sometimes you go systematically through perception, through vedana, through sankharas, these different elements of how we take ourselves to be. And you start to see that there's this whole I've put together, but it's not, it's relatively true, this is a piece of paper, but absolutely, it's not, in the absolute truth, it's not. It's a set of conditions. If you light it on fire, it transforms to something else. Yeah, so moving it from this idea into this direct experience. So it can be helpful to say, okay, here I am walking with this body, but, you know, they say that these atoms that are in my body were present at the Big Bang. And how many other people and other beings and other animals and plants have shared these same atoms? So you start to loosen that construction. You're welcome. Let's see, there's, I think, Sirli, I saw you next. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. So the comment or observation was that different teachers have talked about the choice to teach emptiness or not, and different traditions choosing to teach it or not, and it's hard to comment on other people and what was their motivation and intention behind it. All I know is my own practice, that this I can't practice without this being a point of inquiry. Yeah, that's what makes it alive. Without, I can't practice without emptiness, the sense of non-self being at the forefront. Yeah, because I can't speak for other traditions, other teachers, but I can speak for this here. Jason, you have a question?
Going back to how you were speaking about emptiness and the wings of wisdom and compassion, I'm curious about your personal experience of it feels like
So let me see if I can capture that. The sense of if, wisdom can move toward the center line, compassion can move toward the center line, and when they meet, there's not really the space for the sense of self to reside. I think it's both, because sometimes the journey of compassion is really understanding this sense of self, really fully meeting it, fully opening to it, to all its depth, all its pain, so that there's no sense of flinching. And through that complete opening, then you naturally start to see the absence of self, the sense of that's just a conditioned aspect. Same thing with wisdom, as you investigate and you see, okay, where am I? Where's the sense of me? It eventually shows itself as being absent. So it's both the journey to a place and also in that place, and there's no place for that to arise. Yes, Peter.
So I had one of those experiences of maybe being the fool today. So where I was like, I took a meeting off my schedule, and as soon as I left to go, I realized there were like two meetings with a subgroup of people. And so as soon as I started to leave to go, I realized, oh, I should have left an hour earlier. So I called this person who I was going to meet with, and they were like down in Tacoma. So I had this whole drive down there, and then I hit tremendous traffic, and so it was a great opportunity to see how compassionate I could be toward myself.
Oh yes.
But it was. it was, you know, certainly had lots of painful moments. But it actually, you know, reflecting on it now that it's over, you know, it was quite instructive in that I could see certain tendencies to come up, like, you know, about, you know, sort of like ideas about how I should be, you know, sort of revealed through that. But I don't know, maybe the question is just, some of these very difficult things, and I think you alluded to this, if there's a little bit of space to see them, you can see a lot of, you know, places to work, I guess, through that. But it's painful. It's just, you know,
yes.
Like when you realize you really screwed something up, it's pretty bad.
Yes. Yes. So just to share that with the online people, situation at work where there's an overscheduling and not allowing enough time, and having to feel this sense of, you know, judgment, self-criticism, and also seeing compassion arise with that, and at the same time also seeing how those reveal different patterns that can be a sense of becoming around that, and how that can be a place of practice, but it still makes it hard. It's still painful. And so that it's a nice example, because one is the capacity to meet our suffering, right? And we practice being still. It's not because we're sadistic. It's about really learning, how do I have the sense of holding this moment's experience? So it starts with, okay, I want to scratch this shoulder. Okay, let me open to that. That training translates into when I'm upset. And instead of going into the thinking about it, this, you know, adding on to the self-judgment and getting more and more worked up, you're able to feel that experience as an experience. That sense of pausing, of not moving with it, and you were kind of forced to because you were stuck in traffic, that reveals all the impulses to form into the sense of me. You know, like the sense, the belief, the beliefs, what you believe about yourself is what you said. Those beliefs all show this aspect of who we take ourselves to be. And so we can either argue with that or try to fight it, or just notice it and see it. And in that seeing, we start to see it's just a thought that has a lot of investment and belief, but that's all it is. And when we release the belief in that thought, we are also releasing our suffering. Yeah, so you can also notice how that experience, you're able to be much more responsive when you got there, probably. And now you're not carrying it around. You're like, oh, I'm, you know, such a... I mean, it's not sticking as much as before you practiced.
Yeah.
Good, thank you. Yes, Rob.
Yeah, so I wanted to reiterate some of the other comments I've heard this evening. I just say that I thank you for this talk. I very much appreciate this and what you touched on. The question is around working on my mind. Or if I can find it, I don't really know what to do with it.
Ah.
You know, so I guess the question is sort of, what is it about connecting with the body? And how can I sort of go about working with that in a good way?
Okay, thank you. So the comment or question is around, what is it about the body? Why is that such a common point of instruction to feel this in the body? And how sometimes that's very inaccessible. Like, you know, I can't feel the suffering in the body. And then if I feel it, what am I supposed to do with it? You know, how do I work with that? So the bodiness, embodiment is kind of a safeguard to being lost in concept and story. Okay, so that's kind of the main reason for that instruction. It's like if you're feeling in the body, it grounds you in the present moment. While you can spend a lot of time, as we all know, being lost in the story and the worry and the anxiety, the grief and remorse and regret, right? So that can be just, it just becomes like this self-perpetuating cycle of thought and worry and emotion. It just goes on and on. And to interrupt that, you say, okay, where is that felt in the body? Suddenly, you stop and say, okay, where is this in the body? Where is this located? Okay, so that's the reason for the body instructions. That sense of orienting to the body then helps us to kind of lose the intoxication with the thought process. We sober up and feel this as a moment experience. It's going back to the moment by moment arising. While the story is like, you know, I create this whole novel about how I'm such a terrible person, and my past confirms that, and my future likely will. But that's all solidifying, it's all making it solid. Going to the body, we're tapping into the moment by moment experience of that. Okay, so then that's feeling that in the moment. And the instructions of doing nothing with it, it's really hard. I remember Rodney used to do these Dharma dialogues, he would say. And I got my courage up and did one. And we just kind of went down to this sense of deep personal pain, that sense of inadequacy. And, you know, he said, do nothing with it. I was like, well, I got to do something with this. This hurts, so you don't understand. I got to get rid of this. I got to overcome this. But no, so he just said, do nothing with it. Do nothing with it. And that's the hardest instructions is just to do nothing with it. So this has a sense of faith that if I'm just meeting this, so, you know, I can't be like, you know, apathetically meeting it or apathetically doing nothing, but surrendering any strategy toward it other than simply knowing it. In that provides the best condition for things for it to be fully seen. So that full seeing often shows a deeper emotion underneath that. If I'm kind of stuck in remorse and sadness, I feel maybe the anger or the fear underneath that. And I, you know, you can notice at the same time the deep beliefs like, oh, I'm not lovable, or I won't survive if I'm not loved, or, you know, all those deep qualities. And each one of those, as they show themselves, you do nothing with it. You just be with that. And that is teaching you this capacity to meet this moment's experience, and at some point you just see that itself as empty. It's like you're seeing something arise through the muck of your consciousness, and you're seeing one surface of it. But if you do nothing with it, it just naturally starts to rise more and more to finally see, oh, there's not going down to the taproot of my very being. There's nothing here, actually. But when I see it, I'm doing something with it. I'm just staying at that certain level. So I just, okay, I'm just going to do nothing with it. And by itself, it just starts to float up. Okay? And this process, it may just be a few moments, it may be a few months or a few years. And it may be, you know, for different timing for different people, different, you know, qualities of it. But this process, that trust and that patience to just do nothing with it. Yeah, thank you.